And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sidney Wildsmith.
God love the prophets. They give us fair warning that change is coming. Today, we explore a little-known effort by the U.S. government to save the grand picture of our land before it's too late. This is our wake-up call to pay attention to this important effort within the BLM to save our vistas and unique places. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? It pays paradise, put up a parking lot.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Apple Computers announced today that they were unveiling their newest iMac. Lots of brushed aluminum and glass, making it greener. It's fast and it's sleek. Mac addicts around the world began drooling on their old plastic keyboards while they stared at the newest iMac on their old Mac screens. I know what it's like to lust for new technologies. I'm a shameless collector of MP3 players and recorders. I've got old four-track cassette recorders littering my music studio like long-dead boxes of donuts. I'm sure you've heard that Richard Branson, that bigger-than-life CEO of Virgin Airways and Virgin Music, and a great friend of the environment, is launching, literally, Virgin Galactic, making suborbital spaceflight a reality for ordinary millionaires.
Well, hello, I'm Richard Branson. We've been fortunate enough to have achieved some pretty extraordinary things at Virgin over the years. Virgin Galactic is now well on its way to becoming the world's first commercial space line. We're designing our spacecraft so that each of our passengers will have the room and the freedom to enjoy the amazing sensation of weightlessness. Large panoramic windows will allow you to see clearly the curved Earth over 100 kilometers below. Our suborbital space trips promise to be the most intense and wonderful experiences that our passengers have ever had. I spotted this cover of an Australian popular science magazine which had run a great story on Virgin Galactic. Holidays in Space, book now. It seems almost unbelievable, but it is the reality. Every day, people from all walks of life and many different countries are making reservations with us to experience space for themselves. Well, I hope you'll be as excited and inspired by Virgin Galactic's mission as I am. And I'll see you up there.
If I had the money, I'd go. I recently happened upon a website for Dubai. It is literally being promoted as the new world capital. And it is like nothing I've ever really imagined. It's like Scientific American on steroids. The centerpiece is the Burj Dubai, which will be the tallest building in the world, with 200 stories. It is freakishly astonishing. I hope someday to see it. Everything is shifting. The old third world is now more like the seventh world. In New York City yesterday, heavy rains flooded subways and closed the airports. I hardly heard a thing about it in the news. And in case you missed it, the annual monsoon rains in India and Bangladesh, the heaviest in over 50 years, displaced tens of millions of people. Estimates are that 14 million people have been forced to move. I haven't seen a single story on it in the news. Everything is changing so fast. It's hard to know what has significance any longer, and that's why I find today's story so appealing. I doubt that many of you know that the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, has a program to protect our natural landscapes. That's right, our natural landscapes. It's called the National Landscape Conservation System. There's a small but dedicated staff who are identifying and listing lands and places that deserve to be preserved because they are disappearing. Vast unbroken vistas, unique rock formations, special rivers and trails that have existed for eons of time and formed the backdrop to Native Americans, our early Western settlers, dusty Old West towns, small towns living through the Great Depression, and now, small towns and communities that represent a way of life deeply rooted in our Western traditions. The system is hopefully going to receive a mandate from Congress to actually preserve, to whatever degree possible, these vestiges of our golden age of destiny. We visit with the director of the NLCS, the National Landscape Conservation System, during our second segment. But right now, it's time for the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sidney Wildsmith, and we continue now with our Summer Summit series. Our first guest is the president of the Sierra Club, Carl Pope, who has some great news and some great challenges. Carl?
T. Boone Pickens sold his coal stocks this summer. Wall Street analysts say you should too. America's first cellulosic ethanol plant, fueling your car with wood waste from pulp mills, just broke ground in Georgia. The demand for solar power is so great, it's hard to get panels for your roof. 1 million hybrid cars have been sold, and sales of inefficient pickup trucks are slumping. But government still gets in the way. The new energy economy is hampered by regulations. You can't ship wind turbines from state to state. If you generate solar or wind power in your home or business, you may not be able to sell it back to the grid. Wind farms can't get access to transmission lines. In some cities, it's still illegal to have a reflective roof to lower your cooling bill. We need a sustainable, competitive energy sector, and government needs to encourage, not cripple, innovation.
Thank you, Carl. With all of the good news about the enormous economic investments in clean technologies comes a long-range vision that will need to be addressed. We now welcome Dr. Charles Kennel, whose job it is to think about jobs of the future. Dr. Kennel.
It's very interesting. People are, some people are very interested in building prize-winning buildings, green buildings. They have very small carbon and environmental footprints. And so they build these wonderful adjustable buildings, with automated systems that adjust the sunlight and the temperature and the humidity and use as much passive control as they can. These are all very advanced buildings. And then they build the building, they win a prize, and then what happens? The client of the architect has a business to run. They live in this building. And so they turn it over to their usual staff, who are the janitors, to operate. And very often, these folks don't have enough education and experience to run a complicated building. Well, is anybody trained in building management in today's schools of architecture? Anybody thought about the need to have a PhD level or a master's degree level building engineer operate a green complex of buildings? Well, the answer is people are beginning to think about it, but in order to get the schools to change their curriculum and to turn out a new type of graduate, the graduate specialty and certify it and so forth, all the things that people do, those are going to take a decade or more. But you can see that at the end of the day, if you were to really tighten up your education and training, you would then create a much larger demand for highly efficient but very sophisticated buildings. That would make a big difference. In some countries, I think in Britain where I just was, the built environment is responsible for about 40% of its greenhouse gas emissions. So being very careful about how you construct new buildings and how you operate them, and in their case, how you retrofit older buildings, all of that becomes an important goal for the future, and it takes a different kind of training and outlook to begin to accomplish in that arena. it will be done. People are going to do it, but it's going to take a while.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. Dr. Mark Beckhoff is a champion of animal intelligence, cognition, and emotions. He recently returned from an international conference which discussed such issues and wishes to share his observations with you now. Dr. Beckhoff.
There were really interesting papers on culture and animals, and I think I've told you in the past, I've got this four-volume encyclopedia coming out on human-animal relationships. So I was very sensitive to, you know, what issues were really pertinent. I hate to just come across in such a kind of Western way, but there was a lot of sympathy, of course, for local indigenous people who, say, hunt animals, but yet show respect and reverence for them. There was absolutely not one person at this meeting who sanctioned whaling, and there wasn't one person at this meeting who felt that, you know, there was any justification for Japan or Iceland or other countries to, you know, keep on or resume whaling. But there were a lot of discussions about local indigenous people who still hunt, you know, because they can't get alternative sources of protein or something like that.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. And finally, Ben Lowe brings his commitment to a spiritual and moral imperative to address some of the dilemmas we will face in the years ahead. Ben?
Did you hear about the vast underground lake some scientists have found in the Darfur region of Sudan? It hit the news in July of 2007 and then was quickly followed up with a caution that the lake had probably dried up a long time ago. Now, why would the possibility of an underground lake, as big as it is, make headlines all over the world? Well, it occurred in a region that has been plagued with an ongoing genocide that many experts believe is fueled by environmental degradation and a lack of natural resources. The UN has stated that there is little prospect of peace in Darfur unless the environmental issues are first addressed. So scientists hope that finding a new source of water will help end the mindless violence there. This is a tragic story that people need to hear more about. One of the big objections I still face in my work on environmental stewardship is that we're focusing too much on the little critters and thus overlooking all the real big atrocities of today, such as the war in Darfur. The truth, though, is that these issues are all very much interconnected. We cannot live apart from our environment. No one should have to choose between caring for the planet or caring for people. That's a shameful choice. We must find better ways of caring for both.
Thanks, Ben. Change is inevitable, but it seems many of us should have the right to keep what we value as communities here and around the world. 200-story buildings are impressive, but so is the sound of a whippoorwill, or the deep gurgle of water over a simple branch in a river where I sit alone. Coming up, a most amazing little-known entity of our public land system that has the task of defining the value of serenity and grandeur and working to keep such available for generations to come, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Seems ago that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees.
That is Joni Mitchell, who warned us over 35 years ago about waking up to the destruction of our paradise. And the beat goes on, and it likely will until something drastic happens. But a few years back, someone had the sense imparted in that song and decided to keep what's important to us. And so, in just a moment, we go in-depth with the National Landscape Conservation System when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. In many respects, I was very lucky to have grown up in the Midwest because it was a place where the local people had a unique connection with the land because it was a very agrarian-based society. Although I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which was a city, I would have the good luck and good fortune every summer to head out to my grandparents who lived in Woodville, Wisconsin. If anybody in Woodville is listening, hello, population 300 and some people, and it was great. But about 1955, 1956, I was again fortunate because Disneyland had opened and my mother decided it was important for we kids to experience this grand thing and as well to meet some relatives that we hadn't been in that close of contact with. So we hopped in a train and leaving from Milwaukee, headed down to Chicago and then headed west. And that journey affected my life to this day because for days we spent our times creeping into the western landscape. And the farther and the deeper we got, the more my mind just was taken away to places that I couldn't believe. It allowed my imagination to wander infinitely. And I was impressed with the grand, open spaces where there was nobody. Nobody for as far as I could see for hours and hours and hours. Occasionally we'd pass through little towns and communities. I'd recall, as we rode along on the train, seeing literally Native Americans, otherwise at that time known as Indians, on horseback. And I just couldn't believe it. I thought, this is all real. And as well, you'd see cowboys, cowboy hats on horseback. And what had I thought was sort of a legend of cowboys and Indians was in fact real. And I was totally drawn to that sense of America, the sense of open spaces and freedom. And it's what I dedicate my life to this day. Through the Wild Side News and the effort to make sure somehow that we're able to maintain this amazing landscape that we have. And that's one of the reasons that I'm really thrilled to welcome to the Wild Side News Elena Daly, who's the director of the National Landscape Conservation System that is associated with the Bureau of Land Management. She's talking to us now from Washington, D.C. Elena, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney. I'm really pleased to be here.
The National Landscape Conservation System is one that I've kind of known about, but I haven't heard very much about, and there's some reasons for that. What I'd like to do now is to really, really bring this information out to my listening public and to the world at large. Let's talk a little bit about the National Landscape Conservation System and what its mission is.
Our mission is to conserve and protect and restore those wonderful vistas that you very aptly described in your introduction of the American West, not just the visual, but the cultural, the socioeconomic ties, the working landscape that is a part of that wonderful landscape. When you look out, and I keep a quote on my desk, and it says, there is a landscape larger than the one you see. And it reminds me that when you look out there, you see part of it, but there is so much more going on within it. And that's what we're really after, is to make sure that these very special places in American history, what you described as these places of the mythic American West, remain as much as they can in their original context.
What's so fascinating about this is the fact that what we're really talking about is preserving what is America. We are a people of the West, of open spaces, of a sense of freedom. And that relationship of people to their land in a sort of a natural balance is what so many of us value. And actually, it's a way of life. So you have quite a challenge here. You are dedicated to trying to keep that sense of America alive. And talk a little bit about the scope of the National Landscape Conservation System in terms of the land that you are working to preserve and the landscapes.
Well, while you're right, it's a challenge. I have to tell you, I think I have the best job in government. So we are a very diverse system. We have just about anything you can mention, think of. We have national monuments. We have national conservation areas, very similar to the Park Service, our sister agency. We also have wild and scenic rivers. We have historic and scenic trails, the California Trail, the Oregon Trail, those wonderful trails of visions and dreams that carried people west. We have the Old Spanish Trail, the De Anza Trail, these trails associated with the wonderful Spanish settlements of the Southwest, and a good many of them based on original Native American footpaths. So there's a whole bunch of stories surrounded there. And then wilderness areas, areas that Congress has set aside as part of our wilderness preservation system. So it's extremely diverse, but the commonality is always the American vision and dream and quest. It's a wonderful story of the American psyche.
I think you're right. You have one of the most interesting jobs that I can imagine.
Yeah, it's great fun.
it is. You're very, very lucky. Talk a little bit about how it came to be, because it was initiated in 2000. Give us a little history.
It was June of 2000 when Secretary Bruce Babbitt, then Secretary of the Interior, set aside a group of national monuments, some of which had already been established for the Bureau of Land Management, but he collected them into this system. And what he wanted to do was to tell a different story than the National Park Service tells with its wonderful land, or the National Forest System, or the National Wildlife Refuge System. All of those have slightly different missions. And what he wanted to do, he is a native Arizonan, so he knew the story of the West very well. He wanted to tell that story, and he wanted to tell it in its own context. So he pulled together these special places and said, here's what we're going to do. We're not only going to pull them together, we're also going to talk about keeping them the way they are. And that's not a preservation. He very carefully chose the word conservation, which is a balance between use and sustainability, and that's really important for us. So when you go on to any one of these units, you very likely will see grazing. You very likely will see all sorts of recreation. People will be rafting rivers. They will be hiking wilderness areas. They will be doing a variety of things, but always connected to that spirit of the West and to the local community, so we can help tell that community story through these lands as well. It's really an interesting both bilateral approach of telling a national story as well as telling a very local and personal story.
Well, you refer to these as units. Obviously, not all BLM lands are included within these units.
That is correct. We have 37 monuments and conservation areas. Most of them were designated by presidential proclamation. Some of them have been designated by Congress. Santa Rosa, San Jacinto in Palm Springs is legislatively established. The King Range, also in California, is legislatively established. And so are a couple of the other units in Idaho and Oregon and some of the other states. We tend to refer to them as units because they're very large. They tend to be several million acres, some of them. And then the rivers, the trails, and the wilderness areas as well, just kind of round it all out.
Well, here's what I'd like to know. Areas, these natural areas, have to be designated as units. What's the criteria for that? How does that come about?
Well, it's evolved. King Range has been around for a very long time, and it's a spectacular part of Northern California. That just sort of came about in the 1970s. It was recognized as a very special place, and Congress set it aside as a conservation area. What we are finding more and more frequently is that local people are now saying, we have a very special place, and they're approaching their congressional delegations and saying, we'd like to see this become part of this system. And some of those areas that have been developed that way or are in the process of being considered by Congress include areas like Piedras Blancas Lighthouse. We've had some interest from the folks who manage that. There are several places in New Mexico, dinosaur trackways and some others that have very special Snowy River, which is a cave system. And it's not one type of landscape. I think the variety alone is very exciting. We're seeing a real trend toward local people saying this is so special and so important, and recognizing that these small communities are seeing incredible growth in the West. They are saying themselves, before anything happens to this, we'd like to see it set aside, and so we know it's there. So people can go and appreciate and learn and be blown away by this incredible place.
One of the grand success stories was the designation of the Grand Escalante as a BLM unit. I know that there was a lot of interaction between the communities. I mean, historically, I'll tell you my little take on this, that there were communities who said, look, we've been using this area forever. This is a way of life. We take our trucks and head into this area here. And we're a little concerned that if you start designating this some sort of a protected area, we may lose that way of life. Interestingly enough, that really isn't your mission. It's to preserve that way of life. Talk a little bit about how in the world you go about doing that with these communities.
Well, it takes a lot of trust building. I think that's the most important thing. And we do a lot of communication with local communities. One of the real success stories in that one occurs in Arizona at an area known as Las Cienegas. And the local rancher was very concerned about how this would impact his livelihood. And he will tell you in very earthy language how these environmentalists from Phoenix came down. They were going to tell him how to run his ranch. Well, over the past 12 or 15 years, he and the environmentalist from Phoenix have become best friends. And the group in Las Cienegas, it's local people who sit down, and these are tremendously dedicated people, who sit down and help us design the vision for the monument. The rancher is still ranching. He's still very proud of what's going on. They're talking now about habitat restoration down there, reintroduction of native species, all kinds of wonderful things that because they've spent so much time working together and built this trust relationship, that the area itself has become a real boon to everyone. And it's that level of conversation and commitment by the Bureau and by local folks who really do love these very special places that allow a lot of the fear and the concern to dissipate. We need that local commitment. First of all, they're the people who know the area best and who know its stories and its histories and the things we should be paying attention to. So you spend a lot of time over a kitchen table and a cup of coffee and just getting to know each other. And what we found, too, is if you get people talking about what their goal for an area is rather than what their issues are, you keep the conversation in a very positive way. And most people, believe it or not, have very similar goals. It becomes a unifying theme. And so that gives you something to work toward. It's been a really interesting evolution to see how that has progressed with in various states. And it's happening all over. It's very exciting.
In terms of the vision of the entire program, how would you define sort of the matrix of values that you think qualify a community or an area for inclusion in the National Landscape Conservation System?
Well, because there are so many diverse elements to it, it's really hard to say it has to be this big or this sort of thing. Most of the authorizing proclamations, whether they're presidential or congressional, cite historic, ecological, cultural, or scientific values that set it apart. And the best examples I can give you would be Caxicatui between Albuquerque and Santa Fe is an amazing geologic formation. It's found on the Cochiti Pueblo. The only other example of this particular geologic feature is in Turkey. That qualifies as a unit. You look at Grand Staircase Escalante in southern Utah, this incredible broad red rock country with a history of settlement and a cultural history with tribal elements and the migration west. It's just a phenomenal story. We have found, additionally, there some of the most rare dinosaurs in the world. There have been phenomenal paleontological discoveries at Grand Staircase. If you look at King Range, that area of California known as the Lost Coast, phenomenal ecological values reside in this very, very special place that's difficult to get to but worth every step of the trudge to get to make. So they're very varied, but as long as you look at those cultural, ecological, historic, and scientific values. Another really interesting one is Canyons of the Ancients in southwestern Colorado, where we know that in certain areas you can have thousands of archaeological sites within a relatively small geographic area. It is teeming with archaeological sites. So it's just fabulous stuff, I guess is the best way to put it.
This image of what it is that you're preserving is extraordinary and represents the magnificent legacy of this country, which goes back into prehistoric times, and as well more modern times in the 30s and the 40s as America was developing. And now we have the challenge, of course, moving into the 21st century, and that's part of your challenge right now, and that is how we deal with the fact that our populations are increasing so much, and there's new pressures from many different perspectives being placed on these National Landscape Conservation Units, otherwise known as the American ethos and culture. This is where kind of things are at this point. You're trying to establish legal protections for this. I believe that that's happening in Congress as we speak.
Yes. Senator Bingaman from New Mexico and Mr. Grijalva from Arizona have each introduced bills in their appropriate houses of Congress that would give legal status to the system. Because it was established by secretarial order, any secretary could actually, I wouldn't expect them to, but they could come in and just say, no, we don't need this anymore, and it would go away. And so the concern has been that we ought to recognize these places as wonderful, unique areas that are integral to the American psyche. And so these gentlemen have introduced it. It has not as yet been voted out as an act. They are both still bills, but Congress is in recess, and we fully expect that they will take it up again when they return in September.
And I believe that people are suggesting that the system may get the designation that it needs.
There seems to be a lot of movement toward it. We've been very excited. We have a bipartisan caucus in the House for the National Landscape Conservation System. We have a group of conservation organizations that support us. There are probably 50 of them. They're known as the Conservation Alliance. So there's a lot of momentum building for a relatively new system, mm-hmm. but one that I think offers several opportunities to Americans. For those of us like me who grew up in the East, like you, my first trip west, and I was much older, absolutely blew me away. The West opened up, and I embraced it. It was just amazing. So we offer the opportunity for folks like me to go out and see the West the way it was, and frankly, the way we'd like to see it continue in these areas. It also offers the opportunity for local communities to keep what is near and dear to them, their own cultures, their own histories, their own stories, whatever they may be. And it offers an opportunity for people to go out, as the West develops, to go out and find themselves. I'm a great believer in the connection between individual spirit and the land. We need that. We need to touch it. We need to experience it. You can do that. You can go into one of these areas and not see another human being for a weekend, maybe. It's a phenomenal system.
We're talking with Ellen Adeli, who's the director of the National Landscape Conservation System, about the importance of these areas, literally, to our well-being. Why is it so important, beyond just the fact that it's a land that could be lost? I'll let you go ahead and wax poetic.
Well, I'm not going to guarantee poetry, but I can give you heartfelt. The tagline that we use for the system is Landscapes of the American Spirit.
I like that, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. I wish I could take credit for it. I can't. But it always takes me back to my visits to any one of these areas. Continental Divide Trail is one of our units. And I stood on the Continental Divide a couple of years ago and could almost see wagons coming across the vista.
The mind sort of creates
it's
that.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the kind of experience you get out there. I was at Pompey's Pillar and saw Clark's signature on the pillar. There are only two tangible evidences of the Lewis and Clark Trail. That's one of them. And you stand there and you think, my word. I really believe that as a people, to know where you're going, you have to know where you've been. And that's what these places tell us. All the way back to, as you mentioned, the prehistoric evidence, but more importantly, the human evidence, the tribal histories, the first settlers along the Spanish Trail, or those who took the Mormon Trail or the Oregon-California Trails and headed west. My family never did. They're all still in New Jersey, so I'm particularly intrigued by people who would cross country on foot. I mean, that's an amazing story. And then when you see what they saw, whoever that first visitor was, you literally gasp in a lot of these places. So to me, it really is rooted in who we are as a nation And if we lose it, we will be unsure of where we are going. And I mean that ecologically, socially, and culturally.
You're absolutely right. It's possible to re-experience history almost as they did. If you just imagine that the car isn't there, that perhaps you're on foot or on horseback, and this could be from Native American cultures, or it could be from as the American West was being developed, but people had to cross those landscapes. For me, it's, I don't have words at this moment to describe exactly what it is, but it fills me with a sense of purpose, in the sense that sometimes I can feel my relationship to the grand land.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's true. I think the other thing it does is it gives you your place in the universe. It kind of grounds you. And whether it's the great view, if you're in one of those amazing vistas like Grand Staircase, or it's the Clark signature, or a petroglyph you happen to come across, it just sort of fills your heart. It's an amazing experience.
Another aspect of this is just the natural beauty. As a landscape painter, I've traveled extensively throughout the West in particular, and I wish that everybody could have that experience. Your mission is to preserve this so that people can. And I actually think that America is kind of going through a change right now, and we're going to start, we've been thinking globally for a long time, and I think there's a resurgence of nationalism, and I'm all for it. I really believe that the diversity of peoples on this planet, the preservation of that diversity is critical to our survival, spiritual, cultural, economic, physical, that we really must find our balance with our place, and certainly that's the case with the diversity in America in its many perspectives. So I'm encouraging everybody to do precisely what we're talking about here, and that is to head out into these lands, because it will reestablish that connection with who we are.
Absolutely. Google us. We're there. Call, write.
For people who wish to know more about the system, where should they go on the internet?
You can either Google National Landscape Conservation System, and it will pull up articles, it will pull up our website. You can go to the BLM.gov homepage. There's a link there as well. Or if you happen to know of a unit, for instance, you might be interested in the Old Spanish Trail, you can Google that, and that will give you information, too. So you can pull it up by state, you can pull it up nationally, you can pull it up by unit. And if all else fails, you can always email me, and I'll send you information. And that's at ELENA_DALY@BLM.gov.
Wow, now that's a dedicated public servant. I'll tell you, I've never heard such dedication. Congratulations to you. That's great.
Thank you.
That is really, really terrific. Let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you face to preserving these systems. What do you consider to be, we'll say, like the top three challenges to these conservation units?
I think one of the first challenges we have is, frankly, we're not very well known. That's why I really appreciate this opportunity, Sydney. Making people aware of this wonderful system and having Americans understand what it means to them is one of the biggest challenges we have. We're a small agency, and we're the government. I mean, most people, you know, look a little askance at that. But I do want to get the word out. So that's the first challenge we have. Some of the others, quite frankly, are ecological issues in the West, and one is the growth of invasive weeds, which is a huge problem. It's not as big for us as it is in several other lands, but it's one that, if you allow to take over, will literally take over. And so we're working very closely with a number of people to manage that. The other is visitation. We're not real sure how many people come because we're open. It's not like the parks. You don't have one place where you can go in. We have a lot of different areas. And we like having people come in. But as I said, it's a very remote area. It's very rugged country, a lot of it, and I worry from the sense of visitor safety that people understand that they're not going to Disneyland, frankly, that we have to do a really good job of educating the public about what they might be getting into. And so if, for instance, someone showed up from, let's say, my hometown in New Jersey and didn't understand you needed to take water into some of these places, that's not something is acceptable to me. So we're working very hard on educating people as they come in.
Since you're directing this program, you really get it probably more than anybody else does right now. And what I think would be fun is for you to choose three of your favorite areas, one kind of the northern tier, the Montanas and Idaho and Washington, one in kind of the mid-zone, and perhaps one in the southwest. Could you pick out three that people, if they were to go to one, they might really get something spectacular from their visit there?
the Upper Missouri Breaks in Montana. If anyone was involved at all or aware of the Lewis and Clark commemoration a few years ago, I read Stephen Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage, right before I went up to Montana. You can literally take that book or take the diaries of Lewis and Clark, and you will be looking at exactly what they were looking at all through that monument. It is phenomenal. So, Upper Missouri Breaks has a wonderful little visitor center in a town called Fort Benton, which is probably 1,500 people. It's a delightful little town, and it's a wonderful little visitor center. It's not real big, but it gets a lot of information out in a hurry. Well, let me do the southern tier
first. Sure, fine.
The one that resonated with me from the first moment I saw it was Kashikatui Tent Rocks. And that's that geologic formation I mentioned between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And for several reasons, it's a conical shape with these little capstones on the top. And you can actually see where they're eroding away. It's not a large monument. It's on the Cochiti Pueblo, and the Cochiti are lovely people. They co-manage the monument with us. It's a really great opportunity to learn about the tribal culture there. But you take this little mile hike or so up among these cones, and you look out when you reach the top across this valley of amazing geology. So that one, for some reason, that has resonated with me, and I can't tell you why.
I've been there. It's a sacred little spot.
It is. Sacred's a good word for it. Yes, yeah, that's a good word. And I think in the midsection, the historic trails also resonate with me. My background is in American history. As I said, that concept of what it took for people to pack up, to sell what they owned, and to take a four-month journey on foot across the country is just phenomenal. And whether you select the Oregon Trail, the California Trail, the Mormon Trail, the old Spanish trails are just as amazing to me. Any one of those trails, when I talk about them, I talk about them as the threads that bind us, that bind the fabric of the nation together. And they really, they're very special to me, too.
You know, the one thing I would encourage everybody to do, there's a movement that is thrilling to me, and it's the No Child Left Indoors movement.
Yes.
And it basically says that kids these days aren't getting outdoors and that it's affecting their literal development, and I totally agree with that. I was very fortunate to grow up at a time when I could just head out and go almost anywhere. But I think it's really critical for parents right now to help their kids experience these things. So I think there's no better way to do that than to head out into units of the National Landscape Conservation System and allow their minds to imagine whatever they will, because that's what they're lacking. They're sitting in front of computers. They're spending all their time watching TV. You hardly see kids outside anymore, and that developmentally they're being impaired because they don't have the opportunity to just think and imagine in wild and wonderful places. So if I were to say one purpose of the National Landscape Conservation System, and that is to help children and parents and their children share what we've been talking about here.
Oh, absolutely. We'd love to see them out there.
Elena Daly, Director of the National Landscape Conservation System, it's been great talking with you, and this is one of my little personal missions. I'm going to do everything I can to help people become familiar with this. We're going to talk on a regular basis and hopefully get some stories from the communities and the people who are living there such that we can share that real sense of, as you say, the landscape of the American spirit. What a wonderful, wonderful vision that is. Elena, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sydney. I appreciate it.
I'll be going to space. What's more, my parents and children will be coming with me. Best of all, we, and I hope you, will be traveling on a spaceship owned and operated by Virgin Galactic.
We are moving into a whole new age. Up until now, even those wealthiest few were earthbound creatures. But now, people are pushing out and away from our Earth in amazing and astonishing ways. And those left behind are increasingly left to scramble and fight for what's left. It's not good or bad. It's called progress. And humans are addicted to it. To paraphrase one of the most successful programs to fight addiction, the 12-step program of AA, we have to admit that we are powerless over our addiction, that our lives have become unmanageable.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday, or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.